Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007. At a time when so many poets are content to be skillful and trivial, Galway Kinnell speaks with a big voice about the whole of life, said Robert Langbaum in the American Poetry Review. Over a career in poetry that spans 5 decades and 12 collections, Galway Kinnell has received the Pulitzer Prize, a National Book Award, the Frost Medal, and a MacArthur Fellowship. In the nomination for the 2003 National Book Award, the judges called Kinnell America's preeminent visionary, whose work greets each new age with rapture and abundance and sets him at the table with his mentors, Rilke, Whitman, and Frost. Kinnell's volumes of poetry include Strong as Your Hold, A New Selected Poems, Imperfect Thirst, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, Selected Poems, The Book of Nightmares, Body Rags, and What a Kingdom It Was. He is the editor of The Essential Whitman, and he's also published translation of works by Yves Bonnefoy, Yvan Gol, and François Villon, and Rilke. His varied career has taken him to Iran as a teacher and journalist and to Louisiana as a field worker with the Congress of Racial Equality. He served as the state poet of Vermont and was the Eric Maria Remarque Professor of Creative Writing at New York University for 25 years. He's currently a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. Adrian Fraser from the Curt International Festival of Literature in Ireland noted, in Galway Kinnell's books, you could find how to greet the birth of your first child, what it was like to father young ones and comfort them from night terrors, to experience the death of friends, to find love again in the middle of the journey, to have lived long enough so that looking backward discovers mysterious depths, to discover a true relation to other creatures and to nature and the seasons, as the world is made more and more strange by the apocalyptic accelerating spread of our own species. It is with great pleasure that I ask you to please welcome Galway Kinnell to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for coming. And I'm going to read some poems, and then I'm going to stop and ask if any of you have any questions, and then I'll continue to read and end with a poem. There was a wonderful short story writer and who had started life as a poet and then become famous as a short story writer and then turned back to poetry. And that's Grace Paley, and she died about 6 weeks ago. And she was a neighbor of mine in Vermont, and nothing is the same for me now that she's gone. This is a poem of hers called Here. It's about, I guess you could say it's about who she is or who she feels she is and who she wishes she were. And it turns out the answer is the same to both. She is who she wanted to be. Here I am in the garden laughing, an old woman with heavy breasts and a nicely mapped face. How did this happen? Well, that's who I wanted to be. At last, a woman in the old style, sitting stout thighs apart under a big skirt, grandchild sliding off on my lap a pleasant summer perspiration. That's my old man across the yard. He's talking to the meter reader. He's telling him the world's sad story. How electricity is oil or uranium and so forth. I tell my grandson, run over to your grandpa. Ask him to sit beside me for a minute. I am suddenly exhausted by my desire to kiss his sweet explaining lips. St. Francis and the Sow. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower, for everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. As St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch, blessings of earth on the sow. And the sow began remembering all down her thick length from the earthen snout through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine down through the great broken heart to the sheer blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering from the 14 teats into the 14 mouths sucking and blowing beneath them, the long, perfect loveliness of sow. Not too many years after the end of World War II, I visited Japan, and I went to Nagasaki and to Hiroshima, thinking I would write about them, but it was too overpowering, really, and also there was nothing there. But they did have little museums, tiny museums, in which they put under glass everything they found that was a recognizable thing. So I wrote about that, and I kind of collated or mingled the two museums. It's called The Fundamental Project of Technology. Under glass, glass dishes that changed in color, pieces of transformed beer bottles, a household iron, bundles of wire become solid, a pair of pliers, a ring of skull bone fused to the inside of a helmet, eyeglasses taken off the eyes of an eyewitness without glass, which vanished when a white flash sparkled. An old man, possibly a soldier by then, now simply someone who will die soon, sucks at the cigarette dangling from his lip, peers at the uniform scorched of some tiniest schoolboy, sighs out bluish mists of his own ashes over a pressed tin lunch box well crushed back then when the future first learned in a white flash to jerk tears. On the bridge outside in navy black, a group of schoolchildren line up, hold it, grin at a flash pop, scatter like pigeons across grass, see a stranger cry, "Hello, hello, hello," and soon, bye-bye, 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 having pecked up the greetings that fell half unspoken and the going sayings that those who went the day it happened, a white flash sparkled, did not get to say. If all a city's faces were to shrink back all at once from their skulls, would a new sound come into existence, audible above moans eaves extract from wind that smooths the grass on graves, or raspings heart's blood greases still, or wails infants trill, born already skillful at the grandpa's rattle, or infra screams bitter knowledge's speechlessness memorized at that white flash inside closed forever mouths. Unlike the trees of home, which continuously evaporate along the skyline, these trees have been enticed down into eternity here. No one can say which gods they enshrine. Does it matter? Awareness of ignorance may be as devout as knowledge of knowledge, or more so. Even though not knowing, sometimes we weep from surplus of gratitude, even though knowing, twice already on earth sparkled a flash, a white flash. The children go away. By nature they do, and by memory, in scorched uniforms, holding tiny crushed lunch tins. All the ecstasy groans of each night call them back, Satori their ghostliness back into the ashes, in the momentary shrines, the thankfulness of arms, from which they will go again and again until the day flashes and no one lives to look back and say, a flash, a white flash, sparkled. So there are little odd places in here. I realize that I should have mentioned places where all the music has gone out of the words, because it would be too unfitting to have the words have a music, such as this man in the museum sighs out bluish mists of his own ashes over a pressed tin lunch box well crushed back then when the future first learned in a white flash to jerk tears. and a few other places that that pop up in the poem. Now, now I turn to another. Another locale, but and another spirit. A poem called Neverland. My oldest sister, my older of my two sisters, her name was Wendy, and she was my sweeter mother, and in fact, she was the sweet mother of my sister and my brother, and then of me. We had a mother, but she wasn't a sweet mother. just a little error I have to correct in here. Well, I can't find it, but I'll correct it after I read the poem. And bending over her bed, I saw the smile I must have seen when gaping up from the crib, knowing death will come, sensing its onset, may be a fair price for consciousness. But looking at my sister, I wished she could have died by surprise without ever knowing about death. Too late, Wendy said, I am in three parts. Here on the left is red, that is pain. On the right is yellow, that is exhaustion. The rest is white, I don't know yet what white is. For most people, one day everything is okay. The next, the limbic node catches fire. The day after, the malleus in one ear starts missing the incus. Then the arthritic, opposable thumb no longer opposes whoever last screwed the top onto the jam jar. Then the caraco humeral ligament frizzles apart, the liver speckles, the kidneys dent, two toes lose their soles. Of course, before things get worse, a person could run for it. I could take off right now, climb the pure forms that surmount time and death. And here you have to really know about New York and that structure, the structure of its streets and the names of its streetcars. But too late, must continue here. I could take off right now, climb the pure forms that surmount time and death, follow a line down Avenue D, make a 90-degree turn on 8th Street, 90-degree left on C, right on 7th, left on B, then cross to 6th Avenue, catch the A train to Nassau, where the A pulls up beside the Z, get off, hop on the Z, hurtle under the river, and rise on Euclid under the stars and taste the perfectly circular kisses of the actual saliva of paradise. Then, As if Wendy suddenly understood this flaw in me, that I could die still wanting what is not to be had here, drink and drink and yet have most of my thirst intact for the water table, she opened her eyes. I want you to know I'm not afraid of dying, she said. I just wish it didn't take so long. Seeing her appear so young and yet begin to die all on her own, I wanted to whisk her off, to whisk her off. Quickly, she said, let's go home. From outside in the driveway came the gargling noise of a starter motor and a low, steady rumbling as if my car had turned itself on and was warming up the engine. She closed her eyes. She was entirely white. Snow will come down next winter in the woods. The fallen trees will have that flesh on their bones. When the eye of the woods opens, a blue jay will shuttle. Outside, suddenly, all was quiet. I realized my car had now shut off its engine. Now a spot of rosiness in each cheek blushes, perhaps at a joy she had kept from us from somewhere in her life. Perhaps two mouths, hers and a beloved's, near each other like roses sticking out of a bottle of invisible water. She was losing the half-given, half-learned art of speech, and it became for her a struggle to find words, form them, position them, quickly say them. After much effort, she said, "Now is when the point of the story changes." After that, one eye at a time, the left listened and drifted, the right focused, gleamed meanings at me, drifted. Stalwart, the halves of the brain, especially the right, now as they ratchet the body that's hold the now as they ratchet the box that holds her body into the earth, a voice calls back across the region she passes through, a far landscape I seem to see from above. In prolonged, even notes that swell and diminish, now it sounds from beneath the farthest horizon, and now it grows faint, and now I cannot hear it. Well, I meant to ask, could you hear me? A bit late to bring that up, but everyone is okay. Yeah, all right, that's good. Yes, there's a place called the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire, and some of you I see nodding, you may have even been there, and many of you may have heard of it and places like it, where artists of any kind may go for a month or two or three or four to do nothing but write or paint or compose or whatever it might be. And it's an amazing amount of work can be done under those circumstances. The people meet for breakfast, then lunch is put on their doorstep, the doorstep of their cottages, which are very, very far from anybody else's, and then they meet together for dinner. And I decided I wanted to get even more done, so I moved into my little hut. I took a little bed out there, and I cooked oatmeal in my room by putting it on the register of the furnace, which gave it that same delicacy as the oatmeal in an Irish kitchen when it's set on a hot stove to gradually cook all night long. Sorry for waxing for discussing the cooking of oatmeal. but it plays a role in here. A painter said to me, "How come we never see you at breakfast?" And I said, "I eat oatmeal in my room." And he kind of stood back and said, "Alone?" And I don't really know what he meant. but I thought about it. And then a couple of mornings later, after eating my oatmeal, I wrote, "Oatmeal. I eat oatmeal for breakfast. I make it on the hot plate and put skimmed milk on it. I eat it alone. I'm aware it is not good to eat oatmeal alone. Its consistency is such that it is better for your mental health if somebody eats it with you. That is why I often think up an imaginary companion to have breakfast with. Possibly it is even worse to eat oatmeal with an imaginary companion. Nevertheless, yesterday morning, I ate my oatmeal with John Keats." Keats said, "I was right to invite him. Due to its glutinous texture, gluey lumpishness, hint of slime, and unusual willingness to disintegrate, oatmeal must never be eaten alone." He said, "It's perfectly okay, however, to eat it with an imaginary companion." And he himself had enjoyed memorable porridges with Edmund Spenser and John Milton. He also told me about writing the Ode to a Nightingale. He wrote it quickly, he said, on scraps of paper, which he then stuck in his pocket. But when he got home, he couldn't figure out the order of the stanzas. And he and a friend spread the papers on a table, and they made some sense of them, but he isn't sure to this day if they got it right. He still wonders about the occasional sense of drift and the way, here and there, a line will go into the configuration of a Muslim at prayer, then raise itself up and peer about, then lay itself down, slightly off the mark, causing the poem to move forward with God's reckless wobble. He said someone told him that later in life Wordsworth heard about the scraps of paper and tried shuffling some stanzas of his own, but only made matters worse. When breakfast was over, John recited "To Autumn." He recited it slowly with much feeling, and he articulated the words lovingly, and his odd accent sounded sweet. He didn't often offer the story of writing "To Autumn." I doubt if there is much of one, but he did say the sight of a just harvested oat field got him started on it. And two of the lines, "For summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells," and "Thou watchest the last oozings hours by hours," came to him while eating oatmeal alone. I can see him drawing a spoon through the stuff, gazing into the glimmering furrows, muttering, and it occurs to me, maybe there is no sublime, only the shining of the amnion's tatters. For supper tonight, I'm going to have a baked potato left over from lunch. I'm aware that a leftover baked potato can be damp, slippery, and simultaneously gummy and crumbly, and therefore I'm going to invite Patrick Kavanaugh to join me. Well, here's a little poem called Prayer. Whatever happens, whatever, what is what I want. Only that, but that. Now, I wrote that poem while one of my students, when I was teaching, one of my students was reading his term paper, and I had been trying to keep my mind on his term paper, but I wrote and that drew my attention. I don't know why, and I think it was just to get away from the term paper. And I noticed all the other students had their heads lolling on the table, and yet this man rumbled on with his term paper. So I decided, is, I'll try to write is, and have that make sense in an English sentence. So with that challenge, I felt much better. And I came up with whatever happens, whatever what is what I want. Only that, but that. So it made perfect good sense, and I was quite happy. And the man then stopped his term paper, finished his term paper, and I was very grateful to him for having diverted me in this direction. And I actually gave him quite a good grade that he didn't deserve, but. And then it happened. A magazine came through the mail, and there was a section on tattoos. And I was skimming through the magazine. I came to this section on tattoos, and there was a naked young man. Well, maybe he had his shorts on or something, but on his back. He had written, he had scalded into his flesh, whatever happens, whatever what is what I want, only that but that. And I was flattered but horrified. And I was mentioning this to some people later, And it happened that one of them was a friend of this person who had done that. And he wrote me a letter, the author, not a misprint, but a typo. I thought it was a typo that caused him to leave out one of the S's, because it just didn't seem right to me. Whatever what is what I want to slack a sentence. But anyway, he wrote, and I had told that to these people I was talking to, and this fellow wrote to me, and he said, and no, it was not a typo. It was the reason I changed. I put in only two is's. And not three is to improve the quality of the poem. So the poem in question is whatever happens, whatever what is what I want, only that but that, or whatever happens, whatever what is what I want. Only that, but that. And I won't take a vote, but I'll leave it to you to think that over. I wanted to ask you to, but I forgot to do that, to ask you to think of a question or two, or let me put it this way, if a question has occurred to you since you've been here, and instead of having a Q&A at the end of this reading, where one ends up a poetic reading with questions and answers, to avoid that, I thought I would interrupt my reading and see if you had any question you'd like to ask, and then we could ruminate on those and go back to poems. I think I did say that, didn't I?
Yes.
Yeah. So who has a question? Yes? Oh, now there's going to be coming a microphone to you.
Well, I have two questions. The first is, why are there so many great poets in Vermont? And the second is, when you do these readings, I saw you editing, do you ever have the urge to rewrite your poetry?
I forgot to make that revision. I've even forgotten what poem it was in. Oh, I know, it was in Neverland. Yeah, now, see, this will answer that second question, because here's how it reads in the book. Hurtle under the river and rise on Euclid under the stars and taste with my sweetheart in perfectly circular kisses the actual saliva of paradise. Now that is a really rotten pair of lines, because for one thing there's been no mention of a sweetheart in the poem, and so I changed it to I changed it in my mind the last time I read it, but I'd forgotten to enter it into the book. And rise on Euclid. Better get this down this time. And rise on Euclid under the stars and taste the circular kisses. The perfectly circular kisses of the actual saliva of paradise. Much better. So that's why there are many poems written, like Shakespeare's Let Me Not to the Marriage of True Minds Admit Impediments. There's a horrible line down near the bottom that if he had dared, he would have changed, I'm sure. But all convention is against changing a thing once published. So, and the first part of your question was what?
Vermont.
Well, Vermont is a nice place, really. It's a place where civilization has crawled in, but very humbly, and people live in old houses, and if you would just look at it, and there's not much, well, there is now, you know, getting to be more spectacular houses here and there when some architect moves in, but usually it's just a common place made of little towns, and then a wild area among them, and then another just little town that you come to. It's the embodiment of that stage of development in a country where people can have houses, but they're all attuned with each other, not copying each other, but they just are attuned to each other, and they make an atmosphere that bespeaks love of beauty and of hard work, something like that. Who else has a question? Yes. Yes. Here comes
Could you comment on how you came by the title, The Avenue Bearing
the initial of Christ into the new world?
Well, I came upon that title because the Avenue C was and the streets around it, the area around it, was the a place where Jewish immigrants tended to settle for a while, and then they would move off to other places when they got accustomed to this country, but if this was Avenue J, I would probably have said the avenue bearing the initial of Jews into the New World, but it was C, so what could I do? did you find another? Oh, yeah.
I have a question about the poem Fergus Falling.
About which poem?
Fergus Falling.
Fergus Falling, yes.
It's a beautiful poem, but at the end, I'm just wondering what happened to Fergus.
You wonder what happened? Oh, what happened to him?
I mean, yeah. There were so many. Could have just been a little fall, or it could have been a deadly fall.
What page is that?
My book is probably different than yours. But.
Oh, okay. Fergus Falling.
Was he okay?
What? Was he okay? Yeah. Well, see, it shouldn't be that you have to ask the author. Let's see, Fergus Falling, page 91. Is that your, what you have? No. Okay. 91. So at the end, we ran out, and Fergus falls out of a tree. And the end is, we ran out. When we bent over him, he said, "Galway, Ines, I saw a pond." His face went gray. His eyes fluttered closed, a frightening moment. Well, I probably gave too much emphasis in my own mind to "closed a frightening moment." I could have said "closed a frightening moment" and then opened again, smiling or something. But you know, taken literally, they only closed a frightening just for a moment, and that's when we were frightened. But it's a good question, and other people have asked about it too. So is there any other? Yes. Oh, here it comes.
Hello. I have two questions. One, I'm sorry, is very specific. Cramble, Shinnacle, and Herpel. I'm curious what they mean. Cramble, Shinnacle, and Herpel.
Cramble.
Yes.
Shinnacle.
Shinnacle. And Herpel. It's in your poem, Burning the Brush Pile.
Oh, yes,
sir. Okay. Burning the Brush Pile. Oh, here, it's in this book. Burning the Brush Pile, page 21. And And that happens on the first page, does it? Crambles is one.
Yes.
Crambles. And the other is...
The roaring shinnacle.
Is that on the same page?
I'm not sure. Yes, the great loaded shinnacle roared.
Fourth line from the bottom.
Oh, yeah. And the great loaded shinnacle roared. Well, and the third one. Oh, the last line, yeah. Purpled away into the secrecy of the grass. Did you look them up?
I did, I couldn't find them.
Oh. Okay. Well, crambles. Crambles is an old word used by the yeomen of Northern England. They maintain a language that is a little different from common English. And crambles is related to scrambles or shambles. And it means a bunch of... The rest of the line is boughs, stumps, broken boards, vines, crambles. So you can kind of get it by projection. And then the shinnacle is a large, shining thing. And herpled away. Herpled is a... I would give up crambles if I had to, and shinnacle. But herpled away, if comes in the last line, the snake stopped where the grass grew thick, and flashed its tongue again, as if trying to spit or to spirit away its pain, as we do with our growled profanities. Or as if uttering a curse or wild fantasy, a benediction. Most likely, it, the snake, was trying to find its whereabouts and perhaps get one last take on this unknown being also reeking of fire. Then the snake zipped in its tongue and herpled away into the secrecy of the grass. The snake has been injured, and so it can't go along as a normal being. And herpled means limped when applied to the human anatomy, and so I thought herpled was like. My third is a triumph. Okay. Any other question? Oh, yes. Okay.
Since you added to the essential Whitman, what's your favorite Whitman poem?
My favorite Whitman poem is Song of Myself. Which is a long poem made up I've forgotten how many segments, but maybe 50 segments, and each one is numbered, one through whatever it is, and it contains some of his very best writing, and I would say. And besides that, I would say the ending poem of the ending poem is actually part of Song of Myself. A Song of Myself, yeah. And so much of his very best poetry is in that long poem. And but there's a few things at the end, like when lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, that I like immensely. And there is the the poem that I drew the title "Strong as Your Hold" from. It's a short separate poem, but I don't have the whole poem here, read it to you, and I don't know it well enough to say it. But anyway, it's about a poem about, yes, I don't care, you know, if death takes me, I'm free. It's probably just as good to be dead as to be alive. Fine, but and then he said, but oh, hold on here, be not impatient, because strong is your hold, O mortal flesh, strong is your hold, O love. So that poem I like pretty well. So now, unless someone has a question of, yes? Two, side by side.
I was wondering what poets have meant the most to you, and whether in particular Elizabeth Bishop has meant much to you.
And in particular, what?
Elizabeth Bishop.
Oh, well, I like Elizabeth Bishop's work, but I don't think I gained anything from it, except the pleasure and knowledge that she imparts in her poem. But in Whitman's poetry, I got the pleasure and the knowledge, but I also had my way of writing poetry wrenched around rather severely, because I was writing in rhyme and meter at the time that I encountered Whitman. And so as soon as I read Whitman, I understood I was a free man, and it meant a tremendous amount to me. Was that your question? Yes? Oh, but there was your...
I just want to thank you for reading Oatmeal.
For what?
For reading Oatmeal.
Oh, yes.
And the second is, if you take requests when you resume reading, if you would read Middle Path.
What poem?
Your poem, Middle Path.
Oh, Middle Path.
Middle Path, yes, page 45.
Okay. All right. Let's see, I've got Middle of the Way here, but that's not it. No, Middle Path. Sorry, I'm going to turn back now to reading poems. Middle Path, okay. Just a question, though. Why do you request that poem? Mm-hmm. And every poem he wrote is a poem you love, probably. Yeah. Me too. It has a little preface to it from Christopher Smart, which says, "Let James rejoice with the scuttlefish who foils his foe by the effusion of his ink." And so James Wright was we were sitting, Robert Bly and James Wright and I were sitting in a bar in Ithaca, New York, if you can imagine us sitting in a bar. And in walked some guy who turned out to be a veteran of the I lose track of the names of our wars. They're getting so plentiful. The war after the World War. What? Korea, that's right. He was a Korean veteran. And that was one of the hardest wars and produced more psychological damage in its soldiers than perhaps any. Anyway, so this guy sat down. No, he stood at the table and he looked at us one after the other and said, "You want to fight?" And he was a tough old bloke, but we didn't want to fight, of course. But James Wright said, "We're not fighters, we're lovers. Well, you sit down." And he sat down, and he told us his story. So that's how he handled this man. But in all his life, he foils his foe by the effusion of his ink, just the way a squid does. And I wrote it in memory of James Wright, 1927 to 1980. And I'm kind of describing by my imagination what he might have seemed like when he was in college at Kenyon College. And this is purporting to be written on the, or at least end up being written on the path that forms the center of Kenyon College, and everything else goes off it. It's called Middle Path. Middle path. One at a time, your feet lift and slide through the air and stamp down in the awkward gait of someone who has been wound up too tight somewhere and set down, pointed in two directions, inner and outer, both at once. Past wind-fallen trees that hold up their root systems for psychiatric inspection, past singers who flash the pink of their nostril, of their tonsils, past cash registers that cry Treblinka when the drawer pops open, past dogs who hoist a leg but dribble on themselves, past Boeing wings that lower their landing flaps and reveal tiny white gears. Everything found a way to show you its insides. In those days, when you walked on middle path on fire, in the clear idea that it could be done, but since speech that expresses trouble takes going through hell, also afraid that it could not be done for long. But you of all of us were able to sit down forever, almost without self, with pencil and notebook, with second sight, wherever life and death meet. Today, this first day of spring, I can see you stray off middle path, lifting your feet high to clamber through the last sooted remains of snow, and move among the ancient graves and hunker down at the headstone and read the chiselings time and the chemical rains have spared. And this is on the tombstone, Alfred and Effaced, age 6, age 4, children of Effaced and Elizabeth Effaced, of such as the kingdom of Effaced. So now I'm going to go back to reading some poems. (clears throat) So my wife is a great lover of birds, and in fact she edited that whole big thick volume called Encyclopedia of North American Birds, so I'm going to read this poem I kind of wrote to her. Trying to get into it, some of the love of birds. It's called Field Notes. When we were out at dinner last night, and the dim mood from the day hung on in me, that neither the Canel de Brochet, nor the Pignon Châteauneuf du Pape 2000 could quite lift. She disappeared and plucked out of the air somewhere some amusement or comfort, and quickly back again laid it in our dinner talk. When it was time to leave and she scanned the restaurant for the restroom, she went up on her toes like the upland plover. And in the taxi home, we kissed a mint from the maitre d's desk from my mouth to hers, like cedar wax wings. When I squished in bare feet up to the bedroom, I found her already dropped off, bedside lamp still on, Theodore Xenophon Barber's The Human Nature of Birds, lying open face down under her chin. Gazing at her, I saw that she was gazing back, having been sleeping awake as the tree swallow does. I went around the foot of the bed and climbed in and slid toward the side lined with the warmth and softness of herself, and we clasped each other like no birds I know of. Our cries that night were wild, unhinged, not from here, like the common loons. Well, here's another poem about her. It's about any couple, I suppose, called Insomniac. I open my eyes to see how the night is progressing. The clock glows green. The light of the last quarter moon shines up off the snow into our bedroom. Her portion of our oceanic duvet lies completely flat. The words of the shepherd in Tristan, waste and empty the sea, come back to me, where can she be? Then in the furrow where the duvet overlaps her pillow, a small hank of brown hair shows itself, her marker that she's here, asleep somewhere down in the dark underneath. Now she rotates herself a quarter turn from strewn all unfolded on her back to bunched in a Z on her side with her back to me. I squirm nearer, careful not to break into the immensity of her sleep, and lie there absorbing the astounding quantity of heat a slender body ovens up around itself. Her slow purring, sometimes snorish, perfectly intelligible sleeping sounds abruptly stop. A leg darts back and hooks my ankle with its foot and draws me closer. Immediately, her sleeping sounds resume, telling me, come, press against me, yes, like that. Put your right elbow on my hip bone. Perfect. and your right hand at my breasts. Yes, that's it. Now your left arm, which has become extra, stow it somewhere out of the way. Good. Entangled with each other, so unsleeping one, together we will outsleep the night. And time is drifting on, so I'm going to read a couple more, two more poems. Let's see. Yeah, this one is a kind of poem. It's a poem I kind of like, inadvertently, it kind of expressed what I feel about being. Was some part of what I feel about being. I want to lie on my back under the thousand stars and think my way up among them, through them, and a little distance past them, and attain a moment of absolute ignorance, if I can, if human mentality lets us. I have always intended to live forever, but not until now, to live now. As soon as I have done one or the other, I hear swear, they won't have to drag me, I'll come, provided no one tries to burn my words. The poplar logs creosoted asleep under the tracks have stopped snoring. The bow saws at G, an oak leaf rattles on its tree. The rails may never meet, O fellow Euclideans, for you, for me. So what if we groan? That's our noise. Laughter is our stuttering in a language we can't speak yet. Behind, the world made of wishes goes dark. Ahead, if not now, then never, shines what is. One is. And then I'll conclude with a poem describing a birth. The birth of Fergus, confirming that he is still with us. A black bear sits alone in the twilight, nodding from side to side, turning slowly around and around on himself, scuffing the four-footed circle into the earth. He sniffs the sweat in the breeze. He understands a creature, a death creature, watches from the fringe of the trees. Finally, he understands, I am no longer here. He himself, from the fringe of the trees, watches a black bear get up, eat a few flowers, trudge away, all his fur glistening in the rain. And what glistening? Sancho Fergus, my boy child, had such great shoulders when he was born, his head came out, the rest of him stuck, and he opened his eyes, his head out there, all alone in the room. He squinted with pained, barely unglued eyes at the ninth month's blood splashing beneath him on the floor. And almost smiled, I thought, almost forgave it all in advance. And when he came wholly forth, I took him up in my hands and bent over and smelled the black glistening fur of his head, as empty space must have bent over the newborn planet and smelled the grasslands and the ferns. Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.